Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide, of course, for half an hour or so to better cricket. And it doesn't matter who you are or where you are, we are here to help you out. My name's David Hinchliffe. I look after things here. I'm the Director of Coaching at Pitch Vision Academy, of course, and another Director of Cricket at Millfield School, joins me on the line, as he always does. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Gareth, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yeah, very good.
Fantastic. Been putting preparations in place for the first game of the season. Must be coming up soon.
Yeah, I'd like to say it's all down to me, but it's not. So I've got a team around me that's put everything in place and, looking forward to it. I mean, I'm looking out. We've got the squares covered out on the main ground. The outfield looks as if it's the middle of June, which is fantastic. So, yeah, definitely revving up and... can't wait. We've got a couple of festivals over Easter, so I'm looking forward to those.
Brilliant news. At my club, we're still having to battle some snow, which we've had this week, amazingly. But we'll get there. And one of the things that we have been doing over the course of the winter is coming up with a longer-term strategy for the club. And this is obviously high on my mind because... there will be people who think, well, what's the point of a strategy with cricket, right? We just play some cricket, you know, especially when you're talking about amateur cricket. Who cares? Just, you know, get the game on, play the game, have a couple of drinks afterwards, and that'll be that. But strategy is something that's definitely come in to the game. It's come to the game at the top, and it's come into the game at lower levels as well. And so I wanted to get you... I know that you've got a lot of experience with this, Gareth, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about... you know, why strategy is even important in the first place, why you should look at these, have these long-term aims, and is it something that's come across in business that's got a place in cricket?
Has it come across in business? If I answer that bit first, well, I'm sure it probably has a little bit, and certainly in latter years, we've taken more and more from business when we're putting development plans together, because the funding agencies that often cricket clubs are trying to access money from are pretty bureaucratic, really, and therefore need to have a lot of evidence that good planning and good foresight's been put into place before they support it from a financial point of view. So yeah, that has happened. But even back, you know, I can remember being part of at Ventnor Cricket Club, part of a development planning process when I was in my teens, really, and that was happening back then. And it was pretty basic, having a sort of 5-year development plan. But it has become more and more business orientated now as the funding agencies and the different number of funding agencies increase, and also they have to validate and justify their expenditure into all of the different clubs and organisations that they support.
Certainly in the planning that you've done in different organisations, have you seen different types of resistance to planning? Have you seen people, well, you know, that's not going to work here, and, you know, that's not what we're about? Have you seen a lot of resistance to those kind of plans, or do people mostly welcome them?
Yeah, you get a lot of resistance, and I think that resistance always rises most at the outset, because often when the planning process starts, there isn't a significant amount of detail. It's more of a bit of a global view of where you want to go, and then the detail gets added as you go through that process, and often that's a bit overwhelming for people. And ultimately, there are lots of people, and I think all of us are a bit wary of change at times, particularly if we've had a good experience previously within the organisation or the club that we've been associated with. But often when you're going well is actually the good time to plan to continue that trend or to build on the success that you've had. And of course, people without that level of detail that they often require are a little bit disdainful, and you know, you hear a lot of noise at the outset of a plan, more so than you do at the end when the gaps have been filled in. So even at school at the moment, there's some plans that are being hatched about the way that the school is run throughout any given day, and it's led to incredible amounts of conversation and discussion, and you know, a lot of people haven't been happy about that process taking place at all, but over the course of time I'm sure that will settle, and as more and more information is put into that plan, then people's worries and fears are sort of alleviated as you go through that, really. So it's a normal process, and I think that happens a lot when you're forming teams as well as forming plans. The same sort of cycle you tend to go through, and the first bit is generally the toughest.
It's almost like you have sort of the highfalutin stuff, you know, the stuff that people can say, well, that's all very well, but how are we actually going to do it? And then, but you have to sort of know what that stuff is. You have to make these grand plans, or set these audacious goals almost, and then work from there and say, okay, well, you know, if we want to be here in 4 years, where do we need to be in 3 years? Where do we need to be in 2 years? Where do we need to be in 1 year? Where do we need to be next week? And then when it starts to become practical, you get into that second part where people can actually do things, and then if they do something which they think, oh, well, that seems fine, then you've got them on board. But if you're asking people to do things which takes them a little bit out of their comfort zone and maybe do something differently, that's when you can get a lot of pushback. I suspect we haven't got to that point yet. We're more sort of at the highfalutin stage at the moment, and everyone's saying, yeah, it'd be fantastic if we can achieve this, fantastic if we can achieve that, and it's almost like you have to be as wild as you can to start with and rein it in a little bit and get a bit more practical.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. No, that's the process. Big, hairy, audacious goals is what I call them, and I've been taught to call them, and I quite like that. And then you work your way back, and that's no different when you're dealing with a club as it is when you're dealing with an individual. And you know, at the start of each year, the development year as such, in September, we have those same goals. So when somebody sets a big, hairy, audacious goal, then you work back, and what does that mean? You know, where do I need to be at each juncture in order to be on track, and what are the processes that I need to have performed to make sure that I am on track? And you know, it's no different really, but you've got to start with that big vision. You know, so if somebody turns around and says they want to play cricket for Pakistan, or they want to play cricket for their country in India, then that's a fantastic thing, and you'll find that there'll be a million, maybe even a billion people in India who want to play for their country. But ultimately, you know, those goals have got to be set along the way, and the processes have got to be put in. But unless you've got that burning ambition, then you're not gonna put your first foot in front of the other, are you? So, but it does take time, and it's not a bloodless process, particularly when you're dealing with groups of people, because people have different motivations, they have different ideas of where the club can go. So you know, often there is a bit of conflict at the start, there is a bit of working your way through some challenges, but my experience is if you do the development planning properly, that there's an element of realism, that people are given responsibility for certain roles, and then somebody overseeing that to make sure that everybody is on track and continuing to do what it's put in that development plan, then you can reach some great stuff. And you know, we've got I was involved with Cricket Ireland for 2 years and put together most of a strategy which is leading up to them playing a series against England and in May, which is fantastic for them, the first time they've ever played in a series against England in England, which is very exciting. Which ultimately, the aim being that they're going to be playing Test cricket in 2020. Now, whether that materialises or not, they're on track of exactly where they wanted to be at this juncture with that goal in mind. And you know, some of the processes, I was with Richard Holdsworth, my successor, only last week, and just hearing about how some of that blueprint has come to life and how he's tweaked some of it and how he's added bits in and what have you, it was really exciting to listen to. And it just goes to show the benefit of planning at the outset, where you get everybody on side, all your funding agencies, all your key partners from the different clubs and unions and what have you. And you know, I'm looking forward to watching that series with interest.
Yeah. And that's the thing as well, isn't it? It does give a focus where you don't necessarily, if you're going from week to week, even year to year, you don't necessarily have the focus. You're putting out the fires as you go along and hoping everything sticks together. But if you're looking further down the line, you have that focus on things that you wouldn't have if you just stuck to the day-to-day stuff. So even if you have a grand plan, and even if you don't make it to the highest heights of your grand plan, it's it's still a success because it's given you a focus that takes you out of the immediate and into what can we be, you know, what's the best we can achieve. And then I feel like one possible criticism of a plan like that is, well, if everything doesn't go exactly according to the plan that we set out in 4 years, then we must have failed. But actually, it comes back to that saying of no plan survives contact with the enemy, doesn't it? You know, you have to have the plan, but you don't have to worry too much if it doesn't go exactly dot to dot exactly as you had it planned out in the first place. But it's more about, to me, it's more about having that focus on those things that you want to achieve. And if you achieve them in 6 years instead of four, you know, who cares? As long as you get there.
And in some cases, if you get 75% towards your end goal, you've actually done a heck of a lot more than you were when you started that process. Yeah. And it could be that once you've got the 75% of that end goal, you realise that you've got a really good structure in place, and you might want to take the last bit of it in a slightly different direction, because, you know, over the course of 4 years, 5 years, as development plans often are that long, things do change. You know, you only got to look at if we'd have been planning in 2003 for a first-class cricket club, what would have been different in 2006 after 3 years of 2020 cricket? You know, the focus might have been completely different. So, you know, I think you've got to say that those big, hairy, audacious goals are the things that you chase. But even if you get 80% towards those goals, often that's a monster success in relation to where you started that whole journey. And that's the exciting thing for me. And if Cricket Ireland do get to do, to have 20, you know, to have Test cricket in 2020, then ultimately they can tick that off. But if they don't get to that point and that isn't on the table, then the structures that they've got within the country, with a first-class structure, with a coach education structure, with the way that the unions are running, development offices and all the unions, is still a massive step in the right direction, which will then kick them on to greater things in the future. So that's the way that I look at development planning. And you know, the only time that I've ever seen things actually hit 100% has been when there's been a facility in mind. So you might have a facility development plan, and obviously when all the bricks and mortar have been put in place and the thing is open, then you know you've reached your goal. But in terms of actual overall development planning, I've never seen one reach 100%, but when they've got somewhere near 70 or 80%, it's been a really good process to be involved with.
Time for us to answer your questions now. They have been sent in by listeners to this show, or perhaps readers to the Pitch Vision website over at pitchvision.com. And the best question of the week that we answer wins a further prize, which is an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. You can send your questions into us for future shows by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, or if you prefer, you can get us through social media, which we'll tell you about towards the end of the show. First question this week comes from Romano, and Romano says, what advice do you have on keeping your head still while batting?
Yeah, this is a good question, because the head can move in different ways in cricket in terms. And when I mean that, the head can move outside the line of your base, so therefore your balance can be affected by that happening. It can also move up and down. So we hear coaches talking about getting the head in line with your base a bit so you have balance. And secondly, we talk about people saying they've lifted their head. And you know, how many times have we, oh, you lifted your head on that one. And the bottom line is that the head really can't go anywhere without the body moving it, because obviously it's attached by your neck. So when people say they've lifted their head, for example, I always have a bit of a chuckle and ask them, what do you mean by that? And the reason why I ask that is because often it sounds as if the bat has just been decapitated and their head is in a completely different place to the rest of their body, which obviously isn't the case. Even some of the show back to our bouncers that I faced a couple of times didn't decapitate me. So it's all really about how you organise your body and put your head into different space. So how do you keep it still? And when do you want to keep it still? So the, I suppose a traditional way of looking at keeping your head still is at point of release, you want to have your head still. But we also notice that there are quite a few players that haven't got their head still at point of release. And there's a bloke that's operating at the top of the near the top of the batting charts in world cricket in Steve Smith, who I would suggest the only time his head is still, and that doesn't always happen, is at the point of contact, because he's wandering across the crease as the ball's being let go of a hand. So he's not keeping his head still, but what he has got is very level eyes. So his eyes are, you know, are moving across the crease because his body's moving across the crease, but actually they're nice and level, and he's picking up some great information and moving in the way that he wants to be. Whereas somebody like Matthew Hayden, going back to sort of my generation of being involved in international cricket, he would stay very, very still, and his head would hardly move up until the point that the ball is released, and then he would move from a balanced position at point of release into a balanced position at point of contact. But obviously his head has moved between those two points. So a still head is something that I think occurs at certain points of batting. Some people have it at point of release. Some people then take that into point of contact. Other people prefer for their head to be on the move because the body is moving their head. But at point of contact, you want it to be as still as possible. Yeah, so there's lots of different ways of looking at it, and lots of different ways that people organise their body to put their head into a still position or actually to be on the move at certain points. So there's no definitive. But let's say that you want to have a still head at point of release. Well, what do you need to do? If you're facing a fast bowler, you've got the option of standing still and then moving from that still base. You've got the option of having a trigger. And if you want to be still at point of release, then you've got to get your trigger in early. And somebody who would do that would be somebody like Kevin Peterson, triggered early, got his feet into the ground and was very still at the point of release. Somebody else that would do that pretty well is Alistair Cook. Is somebody that I've worked with that would be still at point of release. Joss Butler in a more modern day and, you know, expansive cricket would be somebody who would be looking, unless he was trying to innovate, to be still at point of release. But even there with Joss, when he goes into his little flip shots and what have you, at point of release he's still pretty still, because he's moved into a position of readiness to flip it up over third man or flip it up over fine leg. So you've got guys like that. But equally, back in my day, I suppose Andrew Strauss would be moving across the crease at point of release, and as I said, Steve Smith would be somebody who does the same. But they were pretty still at point of contact, and that to me is the crucial bit for everybody, because people have different ways of getting into that point of contact position.
It's one of those pieces of advice, isn't it, that you hear people say, and it makes you kind of sound like you know what you're talking about, but actually it needs a little bit more thinking about than just saying, oh, keep your head still there. You know, it sounds good on the surface, but you want to sort of delve into that a little bit more for what your individual way of playing is, rather than just accepting that, oh, well, you know, I must keep my head still because that's what good batsmen do. So for me, you know, that idea of saying keep your head still is not a very useful, because, you know, even in a coaching environment, if you say to someone, try and keep your head more still, then I don't know, maybe that language does resonate with some people, but it doesn't, to me, it doesn't resonate very well with people. I think you have to be a bit more specific about what you're trying to achieve with that person. And often the answer, well, all the time, really, that person has the answer, they know the answer, even if they can't maybe put it into words, but they need to be able to understand what the answer is themselves, rather than have someone tell them, oh, well, you know, this is, you know, if you stand dead still, then everything will be fine, because that's not how people work, not how everyone works anyway.
Yeah, and the head does move, doesn't it? It moves in on its journey to the ball. Whether you're a head leader or a foot leader, that head is going to move, you know, from your stance into a point of contact position. And it's going to be very rare that it stays exactly in the same place. So for me, the most crucial thing is that there aren't many players that have batted in the game who haven't had their eyes level. There's been a couple of examples, but that, I mean, I'm talking about a couple, really. And that's crucial. And most people have a moment of stillness at point of contact, you know, when they're playing their best shots. But, you know, how you get there is very individual to me. So, you know, I worked with two guys this morning, and they did it in slightly different ways, but I would suggest that their eyes were level, and they got into a position where their head was relatively still at point of contact.
Next question is from Mornay. And Mornay says, how do you bowl more dots in the middle period of a 50-over game?
That sounds like somebody I might have watched play a bit, actually, called Mornay.
don't think it's the same one.
No, I'm sure it's not. But you never know, do you, who listens to this show? Yeah. That's the exciting thing about it. How do you bowl more dots in the, well, I think it's difficult sometimes in the middle of a one-day game because captains sort of get a bit set in their ways, don't they, about the fields that they set, and they can get quite defensive. And obviously, if you go quite defensive with your field, then by virtue that you've got four or five people out on the boundary, there's going to be a lot of single options, and then that puts a lot of pressure on the bowler to be able to get the ball into the keeper's gloves, for example, or to get the ball hit into areas which have got their better fielders and those high traffic areas, maybe stray extra cover, straight mid wicket, or backward point. It's really difficult with fielders back on the fence to stop people from picking up ones and therefore bowling more dot balls. So I think the first challenge, I would say, is to get your captain onside or to take more responsibility over the field that you have. And I think we are a bit generic. So an example, and this is proper old school, but I still think it's got some relevance in the modern game, is, you know, who do you want to be bowling most of the balls at in the over? There's two people batting, and they'd have had two different experiences. They might have two different skill sets. They might be in two different levels of that thing that I don't like called form that people talk about. But there's one person that you probably want to bowl more balls at in that over than the other one. And I think that as captains and as bowlers, we can be better at setting fields that makes that person stay on strike for more balls than the other. And going back to where I grew up playing club cricket at Ventnor, that was always one of the things that we were very good at, was as a team knowing who we wanted to make sure stayed at the non-strikers end, who we wanted to keep on strike. So by doing that, we had to bowl dot balls and we had to set fields that enabled us to squeeze as many balls out at the lesser batter or the batter who hadn't been at the wicket for as long or whatever the case may be as possible. So that would be my starting point. Then have a real understanding of what your best ball is. So what is your best ball? What's your go-to ball? And how does your field back up against that delivery? And then also, you know, when we get into variation. So if somebody's beginning to come at you in the middle part of that game and they've been in for a while and they're playing well, then how does that field look with your variation ball? So, you know, if your variation ball is, if your length ball is your stop ball, but your variation ball is a slower ball bumper, for example, that's a really difficult field to try and defend those two balls against, because obviously the lengths that you're bowling and where the ball is likely to go on the ground are vastly different. So, you know, can you marry up your variation ball to coincide with the field that you've got set for your stop ball? And that's why somebody like a Malinga has gone pretty well in shorter format cricket, is because he's been able to bowl a lot of dots, because his length ball is into the pitch, hard into the pitch, can be set the same field as his Yorker, really. So, yeah, you might want to think along those lines. But the first thing you do is make sure your field works for you and you're not bowling too many balls at the guy that you don't want to be bowling at.
I think there's definitely a mindset part to it as well. Clearly, the field's one of the biggest influence, because, as you say, if you've got a lot of guys on the boundary, you're going to be giving away a lot of ones and twos. That's the decision that is made between the captain and the bowler, and depending on the game situation. But I definitely think there's a mindset element to it. I have an ongoing discussion with one of our spinners who convinced in the argument that I don't know how to bowl dots. When the captain says to me, I need you to bowl dots, I need you to keep it tight, I don't know how to do that. I'm a wicket-taking bowler. I spin the ball hard. I bowl outside off stump and I rip it through the gate and I get people out bowled and caught behind and, you know, I take wickets. I'm a strike bowler. And he says it confuses him when the captain says, I need you to bowl defensively here. And so you almost have to think like, well, bowling dots isn't even necessarily bowling defensively, is it? It's just a different way of creating pressure to win games. And in which case, you're still attacking, aren't you? So I would try and say to him, well, look, you know, regardless of the tactic, regardless of whether you see yourself as the guy who is, you know, ripping the ball through the gate or the guy who is spearing the ball in at leg stump, it's all in the effort of getting the opposition to score fewer runs than you. And that wins you one day games. So it doesn't matter how you do it. It's almost like you don't have to worry about how. You just have to worry about the mindset of saying, well, you know, the whole idea here is to win this match. And if we're trying to win this match, then I'll use all the tools at my disposal. And if the captain says to me, keep that run rate down, then that's the job you need to think about doing rather than seeing yourself as the strike bowler.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But also I would say that for that guy who's trying to rip it back through the gate is an off spinner, then we can set a field that allows him to do that, but also, he can defend it as well. And Shane Warne was really good at saying, you know, sometimes he'd bowl attackingly with an attacking field. Other times he would attack with a slightly defensive field, depending, and that could do the same job, you know, that he's still looking to get bowls, he's still looking to get LBWs, he might still have a slip in, which is trying to get the nick off, but he can still attack with a defensive field, depending on the intention of that batter. So for me, fields are the starting point of it, and I think that guy, we could encourage him to keep attacking, but we set a field which is going to keep people on strike. We might still have the deep cow in and the deep square in, because if he's spinning it that much, the chances of somebody going inside out over cover are pretty remote, and actually he's going to bowl a pretty poor ball and need to get hit off the back foot to go through cover. So you could probably squeeze a bloke up on the offside, or maybe even take him out from the offside and stick him on the leg side, save him one. So I think, again, the field's always the first bit that can change, and I think we run into the habit of trying to change our main deliveries, whereas the first thing we should be doing is changing our field before we try to change the way that we bowl.
Yeah, it's almost like the field dictates more whether you're attacking or not than the actual deliveries that you're bowling, because few people can do everything. But you know what your stock ball is, you know what your ball is that is most likely to get you wicket, you know what your variations are, and then if you set the field accordingly, then that sits above what types of delivery you're bowling. Because if you set the field accordingly and then you bowl the ball that's going to hit the top of off stump, then, you know, especially as a spinner in the middle overs, then that's depending on how the batsman reacts is the next point. But it all starts, as you said, Gareth, it all starts with that field, and then you almost don't have to worry about how to bowl dots or how to take wickets. You're going back to, I'm bowling as best that I can.
Yeah, definitely, and that's a crucial bit for me. And I think somebody like Stuart Broad was absolutely brilliant at it in one day cricket, and in particular 2020 cricket, where he would almost telegraph the balls that he was going to bowl, but because his field was set in such a really clever way and it correlated so well to the balls that he was going to bowl, it made it really difficult for the batters to score, to get off strike and all of those things. And as a result, he built up pressure, and for 2 or 3 years I thought he was one of the best exponents of short format dot building as a result.
Yeah, and you do see it, don't you? You see it all the time. You see a guy hit the ball to cover, hit the ball to extra cover, hit the ball to mid off, and then suddenly you're thinking, oh, well, hang on a minute, how am I going to get run here? But actually, you know, there's still loads of gaps there. The batsman is in that mind of going, oh, just keep hitting the ball to fielders today, and that's when you're on top. We've all been there, but that's when the bowler's kind of on top then, isn't it? Because you're thinking, well, there's just a brick wall in the way. I can't get through, and it's actually three men standing in a quite a large area.
Yeah, and we do see that a lot. And that, you know, if we flip it on its head and say, well, what do you do in that circumstance? Well, as a batter, you've got to try and take yourself out of that two-dimensional image that you've got of the game, haven't you? You've got to become Balcony Boy or the bird in the sky or the armchair cricketer or whatever you want to do. And all of a sudden the game gets easier because you're seeing the game in a more of a 3D way, and you see space rather than just this big field that's got covered up by people trying to stop you from getting off strike. So there's always ways if you flip it back on its head.
But that is an advantage, right? Because that take, I don't think that is a common mindset among cricketers, especially at club level. I think it's much more common to feel that pressure when that starts happening. So that's an advantage to the bowler of going, well, you know, if I've got this guy where I want him, I don't even have to change the way I bowl. Because he's messing himself up here. He'll probably try and hack one over mid-wicket in a minute. Which, how many times do you see that in a club game?
Four dots.
Yeah, four dots, and then here comes the big swing.
And you can sense it, can't you? You can sense that building up.
And that is just about all we've got time for on the show this week. One more thing we need to do before we leave, which is to decide on the winner of this week's competition, the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the two questions on offer were Romano's question about keeping your head still when you're batting, and Mornay's question about bowling more dots in the middle overs. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
Well, I'm going to go with Mornay. And I've got an image of who's written in, and I'm going to stick with it. And he probably doesn't need too much advice about how to bowl, to be fair. I haven't watched him over the years. But if it's not that Mornay, then there's lots of advice on our courses that you can pick up, and hopefully it'll benefit you. So well done, Mornay, this week.
Yes, well done, Mornay. Don't let the facts, Gareth, get in the way of a good story. That's what I always say.
Correct.
And if someone else was listening, whether they are an international cricketer or they're just starting out on their cricket journey and they wanted to get in touch with us, how could they reach us, Gareth?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That is correct. You can also send your questions into us using social media. The Pitch Vision website has a messaging system which you can use to get in touch with us. Just follow Pitch Vision Academy over there and send the message in. Or you can use Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy, or Twitter @pitchvisionacad. You can listen to the show every week. It comes out every Friday and doesn't cost anything. Do a search for Pitch Vision Academy in your favourite podcatching app. And tap that subscribe button, or click on that subscribe button, and you'll get everything you need there. And if you want more, if you want to head over to the Pitch Vision website, then we have lots of podcast stuff. All the old shows, you can download them, you can just click on the play button and listen to them in the browser, and you can get all the show notes and all the rest of it. There's plenty going on there, as well as all our normal daily articles. To do that, you need to go to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, fella.